today is worship as sacrifice. It's the last in this series that I've been doing all week. I've been trying to ask the question, what kinds of common experiences, that is, what kinds of experiences that people can understand, are coming to expression in the language of the Christian tradition, especially the language of worship. Now, I want to make clear, and it will never be more clear than today, that understanding the experience that we're talking about does not necessarily mean that people will agree with it. In fact, I suspect that some of the things we're going to have to talk about today are going to be opposed militantly by people who do not agree. But at the very least, there will be understanding. I think sometimes the fact that we don't have disagreement with what the Christian community is saying may well mean that we are either not saying it or not saying it in a way that people can understand it. There are all kinds of themes in the Bible that one cannot avoid touching on if you preach with any degree of regularity. And I still remember that I used to write sermons that were very biblical and very textual, but I would get to my parish church on Sunday morning, look out and see the good people there, Will Hank and Gertrude Lansing and Emil Bolinsky and Paul Smith, and then I would either leave out some of the paragraphs or I would say them in such a way that I was sure they didn't understand, so that I could speak the truth and not have to pay the consequences. But the fact is that the path to intelligible Christian proclamation is not necessarily the path to universal acceptance. The more we are understood, the more conflict there will be. I have said over and over again that the gospel of Jesus does not come into empty territory. It comes into territory already occupied. That's why Jesus said, "I came not to bring peace, but a sword," in one of his statements. Why St. Paul is the apostle of the person who is plunged into conflict when he experiences the gospel. The good things I would, I do not. The evil things that I don't want to do, that I do. Who will deliver me, he says, from this body of death? The struggle begins at that moment when we begin to understand what the Christian gospel is about. There are only two types of people who do not experience the struggle, and some are buried in the cemetery and the rest are dead in their sins. So that if the struggle is going on, that means that there is some gospel and some life happening. Let me read just a couple of things to start us off this morning. One is a lovely piece from her Brokering's Eye Openers. "Once there was a church where the people took the offering back home with them. First it was collected and brought to the altar. After they asked God to bless it, they took it and put it back into their pockets and mixed it up with all their other money, so they couldn't tell which was blessed and which was not. Then they left, and all week they spent as though each piece was blessed and was to be used lovingly." Marvelous. Just a few things from Dag Hammarskjöld's markings. "Forgiveness breaks the chain of causality because he who forgives you out of love takes upon himself the consequences of what you have done. Forgiveness, therefore, always entails a sacrifice. And the price you pay for your own liberation through another sacrifice is that you, in turn, liberate in the same way, irrespective of the consequences to yourself." Ah, little poem that he wrote. This was translated, I think, Auden, W.H. Auden. Wish I could read it in the Swedish. "The road, you shall follow it. The cup, you shall empty it. The pain, you shall conceal it. The truth, you shall be told it. The end, you shall endure it. And then one other. I don't know who or what put the question, and I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something, and from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful and that therefore my life in self-surrender has a goal. From that moment, I have known what it means not to look back and to take no thought for the morrow. Led by the Ariadne's thread of my answer through the labyrinth of life, I came to a time and a place where I realized that the way leads to a triumph which is a catastrophe, and to a catastrophe which is a triumph, that the price for committing one's life would be reproach, and that the only elevation possible to a person lies in the depths of humiliation. After that, the word courage lost its meaning, since nothing could be taken from me. And as I continued along the way, I learned step by step, word by word, that behind every saying in the Gospels stands one man and one man's experience, and behind the prayer that the cup might pass from him and his promise to drink it, behind each of these words stands the cross. If we're going to talk about the reality of worship, at least the reality of Christian worship, the bottom line is sacrifice. Lutherans, I think, have a problem with thinking of worship as sacrifice, and the problem goes back to the Reformation itself. We're afraid that if we talk about worship as sacrifice, that we are somehow going to compromise the gospel. I think one of the most helpful things that I have ever read is a book by Vilmos Vaita called Luther on Worship. And the whole book is a play on the German word for worship. It is called Gottesdienst. That's the German word for it. And Gottesdienst can be understood in two ways. Gottes, gods, and Dienst, service, God's service, can be understood in two ways, even by us, if we think about it. It can mean, first of all, God's service to us, and it can also mean our service, the way in which we serve God. And Vaita's book says that Luther's theology of worship encompasses both of these. I've been spending a good part of the week talking about how God serves us in worship. He creates the story, the saving story, which is the story of his commitment to us, his going through death, his putting death behind him so that he can make an unconditioned promise to us. And any gathering of the Christian community has as its foundation, its basis, its grounding, that service of God to us in which he promises that nothing can separate us from his love toward us in Jesus Christ. Not life and not death. Not things present or things to come, not height nor depth nor anything in all creation can separate us from that love, especially since he now has death behind him. But what does that say about our service, especially our sacrifice? In the Middle Ages, of course, it's well known, at least well known perhaps to most of us, that the whole of the Mass, that is, that liturgy, which was the work of the people as they gathered, the whole Mass was directed towards God. It was doing something to God. You can see it already in the construction of the church buildings. If you've ever walked into some of the great Gothic structures that were built in the Middle Ages, you know that your spirits, your attention, your whole demeanor is swept forward and upward. The whole building just pulls you into itself. I used to I have one slide that I took of the great cathedral in Reims, in France, and especially it's a picture of the whole sweep of that building as it moves up towards the altar at the east end of the church, and the gorgeous color in the glass windows around it. And every time I would show this slide in my travelogue, there would just be a gasp from the people who were there. It's so stunningly lovely, and it draws you so irresistibly into itself. But that whole architecture, you see, served a conception of the liturgy in which the altar itself was plastered against the farthest wall. And the presiding minister always stood with his back to the people as their representative, as the one through whom was funneled the sacrifice of that congregation as it was offered to God. I was at Masses before Vatican II and the liturgical reforms in the Catholic Church where not even the lessons were read facing the people, where the whole of the Mass, including the lessons and the salutations, the Lord be with you, the whole of the Mass was directed solely, totally to God. And at the high point of the Mass, where the bread was changed into the body of Christ and the cup into the blood of Christ, the body was held before God, the cup held before God, offering to God now the sacrifice of Christ for the intentions of that whole congregation, large or small, out there behind us, behind the presiding minister. Sometimes there wasn't even a congregation present at all, just people who had paid for the services of a priest to keep saying masses for one purpose or another. Usually it was someone who would will a portion of his estate to that church or that cathedral or that monastery so that masses could be said for the good of his soul. Now, it was against this kind of understanding, with the architecture and the hierarchy and the theology that supported it, that both Calvin and Luther raised their voices of protest. Calvin's basic concern was the godness of God. No thing could be regarded as God, and therefore the Mass, he said, was primarily idolatry. And his main objection in the Mass was to the changing of the bread into the body and the cup into the blood, because that objectified God and led to all kinds of idolatry. Calvin was therefore mainly concerned that the church be utterly, totally clear that nothing, no thing, no book, no bread, no cup, no person, nothing represents God. God is beyond all of the things that we use in this world. Luther's basic concern, on the other hand, was where is the mercy of God? Where is God gracious? In the midst of all of the signals of his judgment, where is God gracious? And therefore, Luther's basic enemy in the Mass was the use of the Mass as a religious work directed toward God, offered to him. And his main objection then was to the Mass as sacrifice. So Luther wanted the altar pulled away from the wall. We're only beginning now to do that in a lot of Lutheran churches. It's taken us 400 years. We really are slow learners. But Luther wanted the altar pulled away from the wall. He wanted the words, especially the words, "This is my body given for you. This is the cup of the new covenant in my blood which is poured out for you." Those words should be said to the congregation, over the bread and the cup to be sure, but to the congregation. Be interesting to ask, you know, how many of you have your pastor say those words in the Lord's Supper to the congregation, not with his back to the altar? Can I just see hands? How many of you have churches where the pastor faces the people now? Oh, that's better than I had hoped for. That's marvelous. I still get into Lutheran churches where the altar is a part of the east wall of the church, you know, and where there's no way for the minister to get behind it. If he's going to do anything, he's got to pick up the cup and turn around and face the congregation. Well, okay, but Luther wanted the altar out. He wanted it not to be an altar of sacrifice, but a table. He wanted it to be the meal. He wanted it to be really the way in which God comes to us. But his basic concern was to stop having the Mass be a sacrifice to God. The question then is, you see, whether as heirs of the Reformation tradition, whether as Lutheran people or Protestant people, we can once again pick up the word of our worship, our praise of God as sacrifice. It seems to me that the Bible and even our Lutheran tradition point us to another understanding of sacrifice rather than as something offered to God. The point of the biblical conception is that Christ is indeed a sacrifice, that he sacrificed himself once for all time, and that that sacrifice of Christ, God's own giving of himself, is present to us now in the word about that sacrifice and in the rituals of the word. So what we are doing when we gather to celebrate Lord's Supper is a ritual storytelling. We take the bread and the cup at Christ's command and tell the story of his sacrifice. On Wednesday, I think, when I was talking about, or Thursday, when I was talking about worship and its societal dimension, I read from 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, where Paul had to recall a selfish, self-centered, affluent group of people in Corinth away from their selfishness and self-centeredness in the Lord's Supper. The rich were not sharing their food with the poor. And the way Paul does this is to give them again the tradition, the paradosis. I delivered to you what I also received. You almost get the picture of a bucket brigade going on there. I delivered to you what I also received. How on the night that he was betrayed. And then Paul just tells the story and says, in a sense, you need to tell yourself that story as often as you eat the bread and drink the cup, because that's the way you proclaim this death, this sacrifice. So Christ's sacrifice is present to us as the foundation for our gathering. This beautiful little thing that I read from Hammarskjöld. If there is going to be forgiveness at all, it always entails sacrifice. That is, someone taking upon himself the consequences of what you have done. But Hammarskjöld also goes on. That means that if you participate in this sacrifice, the way you do it is to sacrifice yourself. Our sacrifice is the way we trust his sacrifice, not to manipulate God. Emil Brunner once said that Christianity is like riding a bicycle with the wind at your back. I don't know how many of you are bicycle riders, but I read that word at the time that I was bicycling about 1,000 miles through southern Germany, and I know what it is like to have the wind at your back when you're on a bicycle. My goodness, sometimes you just sort of sail along the road. At least you aren't working against it. Well, the whole point of the grace of God, the sacrifice of Christ, is that we've got God behind us. He is saying that yes to us, which means we don't have to look over our shoulders all the time to discover whether or not he is committed to us. The sign of the cross stamped indelibly and ineradicably in history. It can't be washed out. It has happened. That sign of the cross says God's yes to us in such a way that we are now free for sacrifice. And that's exactly what Paul is saying in Romans 12. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters. And Paul was a little bit of a chauvinist. He only says brethren, but I will add sisters. I know that's what he would do. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. For this is your spiritual worship. This is what it means to be in on the Holy Spirit. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Well, let's see now where this takes us. The whole rest of the epistle to the Romans is, in a sense, a commentary on this basic paragraph. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. We do that, you see, when we gather for the Eucharist, for the Lord's Supper. The offering begins the celebration of the meal. I think that's one of the things that I had to learn, one of the most important things. I grew up in a little parish church in western Minnesota where my father was the pastor out in the country. We were 5 miles from the nearest town. We celebrated the Lord's Supper about 3 times a year, I think. Christmas and New Year's Eve and Maundy Thursday and one time in between, whether we needed it or not. But we always had a collection, you know. We didn't always have the Lord's Supper, but we always had an offering, you know. You couldn't survive without that. It's you know the joke about the airline pilot who says over the loudspeaker system, "The airplane's in trouble. Will you all please do something religious?" So they took up a collection. Well, what I always want to know is who got it. You know, that's the most important thing. But what this did, you see, by not having the meal every time we gathered, we really didn't have any reason for an offering, except to pay the bills, of course, which is not a bad reason. But I came to think of the offering then as sort of the way the service concluded. First of all, you had the sermon, and then you gave your money, and then you went home. I never understood until after I was at seminary and began to study liturgy what the offering was for and how it originated. The offering originated as people brought food for the meal. And at the time of the offering, someone would say in Greek, probably, tahagia tois hagiois, holy things for holy people. And that meant that all of the non-Christians left the room, left the assembly. All of the hearers, all of the catechumens, all of the unbaptized left the assembly. They left before the offering. They weren't allowed to participate in the offering. Can you imagine what that would be like in your church, you know, if you said to people, "Now, none of you that are members dare put anything in the offering plate tonight." I mean, those of you who aren't members, you don't dare to give. Only the people who are the members can give. Be marvelous. I think it would be wonderful. We had a preaching mission in my first parish in Minnesota when I was there, and we invited non-Christian neighbors to come to these services. So I told the members of my congregation, we are not going to have a collection. We're going to hide the offering plate. Only you will know where it is. You got to go looking for it. Well, it was marvelous. You know, for a week it worked at least. they all went looking around. They had a secret, you know, and they all went looking to see where the offering plate was so they could put in their offerings. Well, I think it would be wonderful if we could somehow begin to recapture that. Why does the offering stand at the beginning of the meal? See, why do we have Vespers every night? Never take a collection. Only when we have the Eucharist. Why? Because we are really bringing ourselves and our gifts to be transformed by the meal. We want the ritual story of Christ's sacrifice now to transform our way of being in the world, our whole way of being in the world. That's why I read Herb's parable about the people who, after they had given their money and had it blessed, took it home with them and mixed it up with all their money so that they could spend it all week and each piece could be spent lovingly. You see, that's exactly what it is. My offering of myself is not, okay, God, here's your share, right? And then the rest is mine to do with what I want. The offering is always the symbol, the indication, the signal, the recognition on my part that all of my income, all of my resources, all of my body, all of me is available for God's purposes, so that my being is not conformed to this world, but transformed by the renewing of my mind, by the retelling of this story of Jesus' sacrifice, so that I can sacrifice. And look at now what this means. By the grace given to me, I bid every one of you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment. That's the first thing that it means here. Each according to the measure of faith which God has assigned him. Now we get some body maintenance kinds of things. I always used to wonder, too, why Paul, in this great letter to the Romans, never talks about the Lord's Supper. But he does. Here it is. Here he is talking about it. For to be the body of Christ is exactly what he's going to describe. As in one body we have many members, and all the members do not have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members one of another. Having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, that is, if you've got the gift to preach in proportion to your faith, if service in our serving, he who teaches in his teaching, he who exhorts in his exhortation, he who contributes in liberality. See, they knew that not everybody who was a member of the Christian community had the means to give. Some people should give, lots. And everybody who has the gift of giving, that is, who has something to give. He who gives aid with zeal, he who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. We're still on body maintenance. Let love be genuine, hate what is evil, hold fast what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor. Don't flag in zeal, be aglow with the Spirit, serve the Lord, rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, constant in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, practice hospitality. So one of the things that it means to make ourselves available is to care for one another. And Paul just heaps up examples of how this happens. Then he goes on. We haven't gotten to the bottom line yet. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Used to think that was easy. You know, well, it's sort of easy, I guess, to rejoice with a family that has a new baby, or to rejoice with a son and daughter who are getting married, and so on. What if you're rejoicing with a fellow Christian who got the promotion that you wanted? Rejoice with those who rejoice, huh? Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty. Associate with the lowly. Never be conceited. Repay no one evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. No, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. In so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. The bottom line in sacrifice is that we will liberate others, as Hammarskjöld says in this quotation, by being able to liberate in the same way, irrespective of the consequences to yourself. Now that is a stunning statement, and Hammarskjöld has caught exactly what Paul and what Christianity are about. I didn't bring it along this morning. I thought about it on my way down here and it was too late, but I wanted to read this section from Lewis's Mere Christianity where he's talking about forgiveness, and he says, whenever you mention that forgiving your enemies is the bottom line, he says, people become angry, not because they think it is too high and holy a thing to do, but because they think it's mean and contemptible, because it's really giving in to somebody else. It's letting people get away with doing something to you. Lewis's comment is that all of us think forgiveness is a lovely idea until we have something to forgive, and then we are really angry. He says, yeah, that's true. And I don't know whether I myself am able to forgive, but I didn't invent Christianity. I'm only telling you what it is. That's it, you see. So that to become the living sacrifices, which is our acceptable worship, that being a living sacrifice is a costly business. And it really means not hurting back. Taking the hurt within ourselves. Well, if you think that's an easy enterprise, then maybe you have not tried to forgive. Lewis says somewhere that only the people who resist temptation to the end know how hard temptation really is. He says most of us give in too soon. Paul goes on then to talk about government. In that famous section in Romans 13, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. I've tried to read this section of Romans thinking of the emperors that Paul was talking about. Caligula, who was insane, who made his horse a consul, whose capacity for justice was sheer caprice. He would hack people's heads off at the wink of an eye. Claudius, who killed three of his wives and was finally poisoned by the fourth. Robert Graves tried to make a better case for Claudius. Those of you who saw public television saw Graves trying to show us a different Claudius. But historians tell us that what happened in this era as the empire was just coming into existence was that Roman citizens were not allowed to be servants of another Roman. So the emperor could not turn to Romans for his administration. He turned to slaves. And they were frequently venal, corrupt, indifferent to justice in the empire. And then probably around Paul's time you had Nero. Caligula, Claudius, Nero. Really a kind of unholy trio. I read Romans 13 as a kind of tongue-in-cheek statement of Paul, because what he's talking about is justice. You see, rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is in authority? Then do what is good and you will receive his approval. If you think of who was running Rome when Paul wrote this, you know he's not talking about the Roman emperor. Or if he is, it's a way of recalling the empire to justice and saying to the Christians, be committed to justice. Given the emperors at that time, this was dangerous, subversive stuff to say. It wasn't saying go along with whatever is going on. It was saying be a partner in the enterprise of justice in the world at whatever cost. When Paul says, I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship, he is asking us to be part of a very risky, dangerous enterprise. No one builds a tower without counting the cost, Jesus said. Here it is. Somebody else said, Christianity means giving up before you have to. Sacrifice is therefore the mark of the Christian. We don't have to wait until our self is taken from us. We can give it, offer it, make it available. That's what we do in the offertory. I wonder what it would be like, once again, if instead of passing the plate, we would have people standing in the front and all of us could get up, give our bodies and our money and our bread and wine in a procession. because the whole of our life is at stake. It means, therefore, that we are vulnerable, that we can be had, and that we are free to be victimized. I don't like that. A couple of years ago, Jan and I were a part of Man-to-Man Associates, which is an attempt to relate to prison people. We got a name of a person in prison, and I started visiting this person. And within 6 months, he was paroled. We helped him get a job. We helped him find a place to stay. We helped him buy some clothes. And then he wanted to buy a car. He needed it for his job, so I lent him $250 to buy a car. He paid us back about $25 a week. Only trouble was that for $250 we didn't get much of a car, and the question was, do we then help him buy a better car or get new transmission for this one? Well, it turned out that we decided to buy him a better car. Only he couldn't get a loan from Household Finance, so I signed the papers. I thought the car would be collateral. But he didn't have the car a couple of months before it was worthless. And he lost his job, and I had to pay off the loan. It cost us about $2,000 to get out of that. When John's year was up, he left the state. I don't know where he is now. We've never gotten any of that back, and I still get angry sometimes thinking about being had. I'm not trying to say that it's easy to do. I'm really not trying to say that. But I think that's what's involved. That's the bottom line. That's counting the cost. We are free to sacrifice ourselves, however, because we really know that there is more to life than this world and more to our own existence than this world. We are not looking forward to getting better and better, nor are we looking forward to an escape. We really have heaven before us as the way of freedom. It says to us that God's possibilities are not exhausted by our possibilities. It says to us that we will come to the resurrection only through death, and it plunges us then, if we really understand heaven and God's promises, it plunges us not into triumphalism, but into the hope, the freedom that makes it possible for us to present ourselves as sacrifice, because we know that the story is going to go on forever. Let me just read one more of her brokering's parables as a way to close this. Once there was a church that didn't have a cross in it. The building committee told them they could save $100 that way. Instead, they have learned to make the sign of the cross with their fingers. They have learned to make the sign over bread and wine and water and over each other. And now, instead of one cross, they have hundreds of them. Thank you for sharing this week with me.
Thank you.